Good morning. And thank you so much for this invitation. Brigitte invited me. I did not know where this beautiful white church is. I am here for the first time, and it is really a beautiful place here and to come here from. We are not too far away in College Place with my family, and it was a beautiful drive this morning. The Sabbath has been on our lesson for now a good number of weeks, isn't it? It's all, as if we come back to it and we look at it always from a new perspective. And so this morning I would like to speak of the Sabbath as not only a day. The Sabbath is not only a day. It is more than that. And also I learned that you are reading the book by Sigve Tonstad, The Lost Meaning of the Seventh Day. And isn't it a wonderful book, the deep thoughts and all those facets and perspectives that he uncovers in it. And it is truly like, he starts out with that line, the Sabbath is like, or the seventh day is like a jar buried in the sands of history, and we dig it up and we discover it every week afresh. So today, that old passage that we probably have learned by memory from childhood, remember the Sabbath, the seventh day to keep it holy, is again with us. And I would like to speak about that this morning. I remember that girl, 8 years old. And Monday morning, she came to the classroom. And the teacher, at that time, an older man, tall, big. And just to know that this is the teacher for second grade was already a time to be scared of. And then to arrive on that first, on the second Monday morning to the classroom, and then he said, "Stay there." And I stood in front of the door, and all other children, all other students were allowed to sit down. 8 years old, and when everything was quiet, he asked, "Where have you been on Saturday?" And my voice was shaking, my entire body was shaking, and I said, I went to church with my parents. And that is when he started to rage. And all kinds of things that he had on his desk flew through the classroom, and he got up in his full posture and asked me to hold out my palms. And he had that long, thin rod. And he counted 10. And 10. And those Monday mornings came back throughout the school year, again and again. And yet, Sabbath was more than a day. More than a day that I had missed in school. Because, you see, when the sixth day came to an end, and the house smelled wonderful with fresh-made food and the best of it, it was like a new world began. It was the tastes and the smells and the people, the friends. Everybody was suddenly present, and all those experiences where this teacher had his presence throughout the week disappeared. And a different world came into my life. So Sabbath is more than a day. It is an experience. It is another world. One of the most beautiful books that I always recommend to my students in the class, because I'm teaching the Pentateuch, the five books of the first five books of the Bible. And there we have the Sabbath traced through all of those texts, more or less, especially in the book of Exodus. So a wonderful little book that I recommend to my students is a book by a Jewish author, The Sabbath. And probably you heard the name, Abraham Joshua Heschel. And he lays out the meaning of the Sabbath from that text, that sacred text that he as a Jewish person holds high, and for all of us as Christians and Seventh-day Adventists, Sabbath keepers, hold as a text revealed to us, given to us as a gift by God. And in addition to that, he has the richness and the history of his Jewish tradition. And so he lays out all those facets about the Sabbath up until to speak of the Sabbath as the sanctuary in time, the temple that God has built in time, not in a place. Because, you see, when it is in a place, it is reserved for a certain group of people who are able to get to that place. But when it is the temple in time, anyone has access to it. So here we are, and the people that received access to that experience of Sabbath had just come out of slavery for only for 2 months. If you come back with me to the book of Exodus, and we usually start reading the Ten Commandments in chapter 20, isn't it? And we know that well. But those Ten Commandments actually start in chapter 19. That is where the history, the preparation is made in order to receive them. That is where God comes to his people. He comes down. He comes down in a majestic manner. In a manner that is, for us as human beings, impossible to suffer. And that is what the people will actually also say. Please, we cannot have this every day. It's too much noise, too much loudness. That is how God arrives in order to bring that full impression of the divine being. It will not be this way every day. But this is how chapter 19 describes it, and yet at the heart of chapter 19, in the middle of the loud voices, the earthquakes and the fire, is this line that God says, "Go down, Moses, go tell the people that I brought you here to myself." That is where God begins what in, I think, this Sabbath quarterly is speaking of that covenant relationship that God establishes. And it is a covenant relationship that is not like a business transaction. It's not just a treaty, which was very popular in the world of the ancient people. It is not a contract that God and people sign on an equal footing. But it is God's offering. It is God's gift to them, because he had already freed those people. "I brought you to myself," he says. And then when we come to the beginning of chapter 20 and read that first introductory word where God's, where it says, "I am the Lord, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery," when we find that line and then continue reading into all those 10 words, it only makes sense when that line is placed in front of each one of the 10. Have you tried that out? Try it out when you read again through Exodus chapter 20 and the 10 commandments. And in front of every one you shall not, put first, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall not. But there is more to it. Before we come to the fourth one, which is the topic of our time today here, before we come to that, there is more to that. You see, when those people hear God speaking in this way, I am the Lord who has brought you out. He is the God who has freed his people. And there was no condition for that on those people. There was nothing said, please, you have to fulfill certain specifics, certain things in order to like be able to get out. God says, I have brought you out. And then he offers those 10 words. And pay attention when you read those 10 words. Ask the question, who is it that was told, you shall not? Who is that? In the English Bible, we need a little bit of an explanation for that little personal pronoun there. Why? Because, you see, first of all, in chapter 19, all these people are gathered at the foot of Mount Sinai. And they are in the thousands, hundreds of thousands, according to later numbering. It gives us great number of people present here, young and old, people who are of the tribes of Jacob, who had entered into Egypt, and also people who came with them and accompanied them and left Egypt together with them. All of them are present here, listening and hearing this voice. And God says, you. Who is it that he addresses?
Each individual.
Thank you. I ask that every time in my classroom, because you see, the you in the English Bible can mean both. Can mean all the people, but it can also mean each one there. And that is what in the original Hebrew text is written. It's the singular personal pronoun, you, that is in there. So in the middle of all those people, no one is able to disappear. In the college church, in the campus church over there, when we have a Sabbath where the church like gets full, right? And that is when students and people from the community and guests arrive. And it is so easy to disappear in the crowd. It is so easy to just, you know, enter quickly, sit in the corner, in the back seat, and then leave early. And no one has talked to you for the entire Sabbath. In this crowd here, no one disappeared because God saw everyone. And God said, you, and you, and you, each one of you, I have brought you out. You shall not. So let's take another step into this. When God says, you shall not, we have 8 prohibitions in the negative form in these 10 commandments. And the two in the middle are in another way placed, right? Remember and then honor. But the you and then shall not that is in there. So what kind of prohibition is that? We use different ways of saying don't do something, right? We use different kinds of ways to express that. And that is the case also in the Hebrew language there as well. If God would have liked to tell those that individual person, don't do that, then he would have chosen a specific expression. If it was something that was immediate, like at that point in time, don't do that. It's kind of like a strong command. And it is applied right there immediately to a specific situation. But then there is another kind of way to say, don't do that. In the sense of, you should never do this. Not in the immediate form, but in the permanent form. In that one, which is something that should always be the case, should ever, at any time, permanently be that way. And in that kind of form, we find those eight times written in our Bibles, in the Hebrew language. And the most literal translation for that kind of expression sounds like this. And now come back with me. I am the Lord, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You will never. You said it again. Please say it loud. It's a promise. It is God's promise. It is that is what is actually what actually a covenant is. A promise, isn't it? And God is the one who makes the promise. He has already done his part, and yet he says, you will never, because I am the Lord your God, you see? I am the Lord your God, so you will never take my name in vain. You will never make for yourself another God. You will never murder. You will never commit adultery. You will never steal, bear false witness, and so on. It's God's promise, each one of those words. And we call them commandments. What difference it would make if we would recognize them as God's gifts, as God's promises to us. At the heart of them is the one about Sabbath. And it starts out with a positive form, not a you will never. But it starts out with a verb that is used in the Hebrew language, and it has a special place in this concept of Hebrew thinking of that world. It speaks of remembering. Remembering is an act, is a way of life that helps us even today, not only the people at that time, but helps us to know who we are. Because we are able to go back and recount and rethink, remember people, remember names, remember stories. And so when God says, remember the seventh day, he does not speak of one of the days of those six. Maybe I should say he does not speak only in that way. But he speaks of something that it has always been an experience between God and humans. An event that God has entered through it into human history, into the human world. At creation, in that story in Genesis chapter 2. And then when they come out, here out of Egypt, where their lives had been burdened by labor, heavy labor, so that their cries reached the ear of God, says Exodus chapter 1, and God heard their cry. It triggered God. It triggered God to remember his promise that he had given to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. If you go back to Genesis, to Exodus chapter 1, you will find that very thought in there. God is the one who remembered first. What a deity, what a God. So different from the one that we like to place into those categories of an omnipotent, omnipresent, and the most powerful God, isn't it? The God who always knows everything. And yet, in the stories of the Bible, he becomes so very human in the language that he is told of there. Not only in the coming of Jesus, in the coming of Christ, where he becomes human, the human in flesh, but even in those stories in the Old Testament parts in the Bible, he is the most humanly described with those words, with that language. And he says, now, after I have remembered my promise, I want you to remember how that relationship with those ancestors, with those patriarchs, went about. And during that time, during those stories, we do not even find a Sabbath day in the text. After Genesis chapter 2, all of the book of Genesis, there is no seventh day mentioned, no Sabbath mentioned, and yet God says, remember. So he asks for something that goes beyond a day, a weekly day. It includes something very much more, something much deeper. Remember the seventh day to keep it holy. And then the question is, so who is this God again? We have learned already, he becomes this personal God for each one of those people who listen to that word. He is the God who speaks directly to the individual, not just to the crowd. And he is the God who has already brought freedom to them. Freedom from Egypt, from slavery. And they are free people. But only shortly, right? Think of that. Only for a short time. Only 2 months, because that is how chapter 19 starts it out. In the third month after the sons of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt on that very day. So for only like 2 months. And here they hear about, remember the seventh day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall work. They had worked in Egypt, hadn't they? They had worked in Egypt hard. And then comes the next line, but on the seventh day, you shall not do any work. What news! How can this be considered a commandment that stops us from our freedoms? It offers freedom to people who had worked all their lives for generations. Do not do any work. I would like to go to two more questions in this passage. We have heard who God is for the people, the personal God, the God who speaks directly, intimately to them, the God who has offered freedom and brought them out, the God who offers that kind of relationship, of covenant relationship that becomes so very personal and intimate for them. And now the second question is, Who am I in this text? What do you think that ancient person back at the foot of Mount Sinai heard when God says, you shall work 6 days, but on the seventh day you shall not do any work? Who is it? Who is that individual again that is offered this gift of freedom after a six-day work? Who is it? And if we understand who that person is, then we need to see and understand who I am in that story as well. Who you are in that text. That is why Sabbath is not only a day passed in history, it is an experience that needs to be lived by each one of us. So, you shall not do any work. But then the line continues. And at this point, maybe you have done this exercise already. But if not, then recite it by memory or check out the text in your Bibles again. Who is mentioned there and how many are the ones who should work 6 days and then not work and not do any labor on the seventh day? Yes, but how many?
Everyone.
Okay, let's count them. You, your son, your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, your ox, and your... No, the ox, not the ox, the cattle. Your cattle and... you're a stranger. So how many? Seven.
But the wife has to work.
I think Mrs. Dalin should answer that.
He was speaking to everyone there, male and female.
Thank you.
And the wife is somebody's daughter.
Thank you.
And the pastor has to work hard.
That's what usually happens. Yes. The number seven, I'm sure I don't say anything new. The meaning for the number seven in this world of biblical stories has a richness in it, where we speak of wholeness, of a household that is like full. Everyone is part of it. That's why it's all. Yes, it is all. But it is that number that conveys that wholeness of the household, where everyone has a place. No one is excluded. The wife is part of the you, by the way. I'm sorry. Otherwise, wives should also not keep the one about do not steal, right?
That seems like people eat on Sabbath. Nobody's got to work.
That's true as well. So we recognize that there is a challenge in this part that is very much present even for us, isn't it?
And God works the hardest. He keeps the whole universe and everything going.
Yeah. So, back to the question, who am I in this Sabbath experience? If I am part of this seven, this complete whole household, if I'm part of it, who am I versus the time in Egypt? You see, back in Egypt, that Israelite father, if the Egyptian slave master would come and knock on the door and say, I need your son today, we need to plow the field. Would that father have a right to say, no, we keep Sabbath today? If that is that Egyptian woman had come and said, I need your daughter today, we need to do the laundry. Would that mother have been able to say, oh, I'm sorry? So compared to that time of slavery, who is the you? Who am I? Who is that person that is part of this household? Suddenly, this person is able to say, I'm going to stop to work. It is when the individual person, it is then in the biblical context when that individual person is able to say no to work. Even good work, by the way, and we will come to that question in a bit. But when it's able to say no, that human being becomes a human being. Because now it has received identity. It is the person who can stand up and say, up to here. And now we Sabbath. Because that is what the verb Sabbath actually means. Stop. Cease. God ceased, according to Genesis chapter 2, when he had created everything. God ceased. So that Israelite person here at the foot of Mount Sinai finds itself within a family, is part of that family, and it is in that connection to the other that that person is now here saying, I am part of these people. Wow, isn't it? It is. We become humans in relation to the other. Even in relation to God, let us make man according to our image. And then God places that human being in relation to each other. That is when our humanity is established. When our personhood is given. And so this Israelite father here now recognizes, I have a son. I am part of this family. I have a daughter. And even responsibility for others. To be able to say, my servant will not work today. My animal will have a pause. And that person that is usually excluded, that is not of your own, becomes part of this family. So Sabbath establishes some very foundational elements here. Who is God? Who am I? The third question is all about how do we experience work? What is work? We often feel work as a burden. We get tired. At the end of the day, we are tired. Sometimes we get so stressed that we have to take a break, a vacation. Sometimes work becomes so heavy that it affects our health. What is work when God says, work 6 days, and then stop, do not do any labor on the seventh day? You see, in this fourth commandment, Adventists have been so very good to speak of the reason for the seventh-day Sabbath as that right day of worship for God. We have done a great job in that. We have written books and done research about that and have established the doctrine about the seventh day as the correct day of worship. And in all that work, have we maybe forgotten what actually the reason is when it says there, 6 days, do all your work. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them. Is it possible that we need to read these lines in parallel in order to understand how God worked throughout those 6 days? So that we know how to work during the 6 days. And that is when I do another exercise with my students in the classroom. I let them separate in 6 groups. And then I ask them to go back to Genesis chapter 1, that magnificent chapter about the creation week. And I ask each of the groups to choose one passage that speaks of the each day of the week. And I ask them to read through it and ask themselves, so how does God work and what does God do? For example, on the first day, on the second day, on the third, fourth, fifth, sixth day. Is it something that we should come to learn something for that needs to be taken over into our lives as well, and not only as a biblical count of the creation and the origin of the world? Maybe if we did, we would find something like this. Well, remember, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And then God said, let there be light. Day one, right? Let there be light. And there was light. And God separated the light from the darkness. And God saw that the light was good. And he called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening and there was morning, day one. What is it that we could take over into, let's say, the first day of our 6 weekdays, from that first day of God's?
Boundaries, separation. There's a separation.
Isn't it? Is it possible sometimes we need to, like, take things apart in order to, like, be able to make sense out of all the mess that sometimes comes into our daily lives? On all counts, on all levels. Like in the life of a student in their dorm room, sometimes you have to, like, clean up the desk. What if you separate things? Put them in piles. Clean up your closet. Very simple things. Things that each one of us have a go through and do with our hands. And we see them as labor. Labor which is where we get tired, where our backs start to hurt. But isn't it that kind of work, that separation, where then each part receives its specific place, its specific name in our own actual daily lives, that can bring us some light, even? And if you take that same exercise throughout the rest of the 6 days, you will come to very similar conclusions, that even a story, a magnificent story about the origins of the world in the Bible, can have some ethical lessons that translate into a person's life even in the year 2021. So that at the end of the day, we are able to say, and it was good. And then if we if we go to that sixth day, for example, which becomes the high point of the six, where God says, let us make the human being into our image, according to our likeness. On that sixth morning of our week, what if we open our doors and look into the eye of the neighbor, the other one across the street, the one that we meet out and about, and recognize that image and likeness of God? And at the end of the 6 days, God saw, and it was very good. And God completed all his work, says Genesis chapter 2, verse 2, isn't it? It is in that text, in that line, where every act of God now is told and is identified as work, God's work. And God's work was very good. How do we recognize work when we learn of Sabbath? Is it possible to see God's way of working in the work we do? Even when we come to the end of a day or even a week and the things are not all finished, and yet we can look back and say, it was good. Up to here, and now Shabbat, stopping, ceasing. And that is when that Israelite ex-slave of 2 months is able to say, stop. And that stop, that cessation that happens at the end, is valid for each one in that group of people, in that household. The one who is in charge, the Sabbath keeper, the father, the mother, the children, and even the ones who work hard, usually, even the animals, and the ones who are normally not part of it because someone always finds a reason to exclude. And yes, here they all become one on the same level. It is interesting to find a passage like this in an ancient text where the son and the daughter are mentioned on an equal level. It is fascinating and it is unique to find a text, an ancient text, not only in the Bible, but in all of ancient literature, where a slave man and a slave woman are placed on the same level. And that is where Sabbath comes in, as an experience of freedom for everyone. Some call it the great equalizer because of those words that are used there. And at the end of the day, it is this God who has offered himself as the God who frees people to become that personal, intimate God for each one of his children, where he takes each one of those, of that household, of everyone, into his own, where work becomes goodness and beauty. Because in his kingdom, each one, according to chapter 19, in his kingdom, each one is part of that priestly nation, that kingdom of God's. This is just one facet that comes out of the fourth commandment here. And we could go on and take on other texts in the Bible. But I will close because I still remember that little 8-year-old girl. And so I grew up and I traveled across the continents. And I found myself about 20 years ago at Andrews University asking what should be the topic that I truly want to explore. And I went to the library, I checked out all the themes and topics that usually students at that time were interested in. And I decided I would like to find something that speaks, has always been something on in my life, something important. And isn't it Sabbath, which is so important to us Seventh-day Adventists? But it becomes important when we not only keep it as a day, but when we experience it throughout each of the days. When it is not only history and 24 hours or theology, but when it translates into the life of each day in our week time. And so in that little schoolroom, in that classroom back then, when that rod hit my palms, I could have easily said, why do I have to go through this? I don't need this. About 40 years later, I decided, I want to know why it was so important and why it was so unthreatening to go on Monday morning back to the same classroom, shivering, yes, and scared. Yes, and yet I did it again and again and again. So what is it about this day? What is it about Sabbath that keeps us going? It is because it translates into an experience with God. You see, faith was born in that classroom, in front of the door, in front of the other students. That is where faith was born. And it is that kind of faith that goes through ups and downs, and sometimes we miss it, sometimes we lose it for a while, but that jar in the sands of time is still there. And you see, God's Spirit is that wind that just has to blow a little bit across the sand dunes to uncover that jar again. And it comes alive. It brings back all the history of time, the history of God's people from ancient ages. Let's keep it alive. Thank you so much this morning.